Welcome to another episode of the Good Listening To Show, your life and times with me, Chris Grimes, the storytelling show that features The Clearing, where all good questions come to get asked and all good stories come to be told, and where all my guests have two things in common. They're all creative individuals and all with an interesting story to tell. There are some lovely storytelling metaphors. A clearing, a tree, a juicy storytelling exercise called 5-4-3-2-1, some alchemy, some gold, a cheeky bit of Shakespeare, and a cake. So it's all to play for. So yes, welcome to the Good Listening To Show, your life and times with me, Chris Grimes. Are you sitting comfortably? Then we shall begin. Yes, indeed. Welcome, welcome, thrice welcome to this very, very illustrious day in the Good Listening To Your Life and Times with me, Chris Grimes, Clearing. I'm absolutely delighted to welcome to somebody who's been called the godfather of modern poetry, or more importantly, the patron saint of poetry by Carol Ann Duffy. This is Roger McGough, whose wonderful dulcet musical vocal tones have been ringing around my head for most of my life, actually. And just
apologies for that, Chris. Apologies for that.
No, it's a good thing, Roger McGough, I promise you. And you also penned Lily the Pink, I believe, as The Scaffold.
Indeed, yes. I helped pen it, yes.
And that is the first thing, just so you know, I can blow a really happy bit of smoke at you, that's the first thing I ever performed to on stage in Uganda, when my parents ran something called the Nile Players Theatre, and I accidentally got a laugh, which got me launched on a sort of comedy career, because we were jogging up and down to Pink, the Pink, the Pink, and I got out of time. And that was the first time I experienced live on stage a laugh, and I think that probably infected me in some way. And so I have you to thank for that.
Okay, that's good.
So, Roger McGough, you're extremely welcome to the Good Listening To Clearing. You know, you're a real thrill for me to be able to interview today, so you are extremely welcome. So, first question for you, how's morale? What's your story of the day?
My story of the day? I don't have one. I got it this morning. That was pretty good. And went for a jog. And then peeled some mushrooms, or cut some mushrooms up, and had lunch with my wife. I'm here. That's it.
That's a great day.
Exciting, honestly.
And I'm very impressed you went for a jog.
What's always been exciting is this, I must warn you. That maybe it's exciting, you know, as it gets. Go on.
But I love the fact you've made mushroom soup. You've been for a jog. So how often do you go jogging in a given week?
When I'm in and around, I like to go most days a week, not the weekends, most days during the week. But literally, I'm not talking very much. I mean, I can see where I jog. It's just around the green where I live.
Yes.
So it just gets me fresh air and out a bit. And that's all. It's I just think it's a good thing. I've always done it years. I was never a good runner. My daughter, Izzy, who's now 30, I think. She ran her first London Marathon last Sunday. So we all went down, family, to see her running along, did the 26 miles, amazing. So, she's the runner in the family, not me.
But many congratulations to Izzy. That's fantastic. Also, I'm supremely aware that you are born the same year as my father, as it happens. So when I heard that you were also called the godfather of modern poetry, that's why I was so happy to make the association, that's why your voice has been ringing in my ears all of my life. Yeah. And I was really struck as well with, you know, one of your most iconic poems, which you wrote very early on, Let Me Die a Young Man's Death. Mm. How I notice you are very, very happily straddling the years that you state, which is 73, 91 and 104. And so I really sincerely hope you make it all the way to 104.
Okay, thank you. I'll do my best. Yes, I remember writing that poem years and years ago in Liverpool, and my father had not long died, and he was only 53, worked on the docks in Liverpool. And I've been brought up, because I was brought up in a sort of a Catholic family in Liverpool, lots of uncles and aunties, and a lot of births, marriages and deaths, as you can imagine. And it's very common in those days, if there was a death in the family, the coffin would be brought into the power, and it would all go there. I remember as a young, you know, little toddler almost being lifted up, seeing granddad lying there, or auntie so-and-so, and all that. And then there was the, you know, few little prayers, and then later on the wake, and it was very acceptance. It was, so death was close to you, but not in a sort of scary way. It was just part of, if you like, the rituals of what happened. But it must have been slightly scary, I suppose. I was aware of it young. But then writing, being in Liverpool, the Picton Library, I remember one day and writing, let me know a young man's death, thinking about my father, and thinking about, you know, when people die at 53 and you're 21,
yes,
it's like a long way away. It seems like an old, you know, long way ahead. Then, of course, as you move up the ladder, you realise it's not that far ahead.
And I mentioned my father is the same birth year as you. He's born in July 1937. I think you're November 1937.
That's right.
Correct. And my dad famously has said, inside every old person is a young person wondering what happened. And so that is very relatable.
Is your dad well?
Yes, he is. That's very kind of you to ask. Yes, he is. And he's doing as well as can be expected for the age of 83. And it's just wonderful to still be here. And as I say, your poem happily spans until you're 104. Mm. So I sincerely hope you make it to the very end. And what's it like to have a poem that most people, well, it's very well regarded as being a poem that people often like to have read out at their funeral.
Hmm. Yes, it's strange that. Because I wouldn't have it read out at mine. I've written one since called Not For Me, A Young Man's Death, a sequel to that, saying I don't want any of that. No, I want, and I don't want any of that. I've written a lot of poems about that, actually, and about I don't want any of that. So it was a funeral service where they say, we're not here to celebrate his life, but we're not here to mourn his passing, but to celebrate his life. You know, I say, oh, yes, you are. Yes, mourn. Get mourning, miss. You know,
get mourning.
Not crying, shouting, screaming. I want that one. Women jumping on the coffin and all that. So it's all that sort of thing. So I don't know. I just get on with this and try to write about it, and that helps keep it. To stop me thinking about it. Writing stopped me thinking about things.
And to your point, by the way, about women jumping on your coffin, that's what I so particularly enjoyed about when I'm 104 and banned from the cavern, may my mistress, catching me in bed with her daughter and fearing for her son, cut me up into little pieces and throw away every piece but one.
Mm. My ear.
Yes, obviously, obviously. Also, every time, and by the way, sincerely, I have you to thank for this. Every time in my life I see somebody wave at a train, I think about you because of your wonderful poem, Waving at Trains.
Oh, yeah.
I always have that thought about, are they waving at the train or at the driver or at the train itself? And that's
or
again,
you,
thanks
or
to
you. Probably. Well, I think it's me. I was thinking they're waving at me now.
And they are, let me tell
they
you.
They are, of course they are, yeah.
Can I say what a great thrill it is for me to be sitting here in the advent of my podcast waving at you? We also have Katie Elliott Armitage and a place called Les Sœurs Anglais, the English Sisters, in common as well. I know you've done a poetry workshop where I also go and do my instant wit laughter labs once a year.
Oh, yes. That's one of the best ones.
And isn't that a beauty? And you've just been to Crete as well, I'm gathering, for a fortnight as well?
Yes, just come back from a workshop. I do workshops over there for most years, every year really. I have been for the last 5 or 6 years. And it's lovely, just lovely. And it's run by a very old friend of mine called Phil Harrison, who was in a band called the Corgis. Some of you may remember. But I knew him before that in Liverpool and to work with him when I was with the Scaffold, and he was a talented musician. And
the Scaffold was Lily the Pink, wasn't it? That was
Yes, it was. Indeed, possibly. He wasn't involved in that, but he was too young. But then he went into academia, then the Corgis and academia again, and now he lives out in Crete and organises workshops and film nights for the expats and things. And last time I was there, not this time, last year, Neil Innes was also there with me.
Oh.
The Bonzo Dog, yes, wonderful,
yes.
Neil.
And his sad passing a couple of years ago as well.
Yes, wonderful, great man.
And in fact, I last bumped or saw Neil Innes, not that I knew him, but because of being in Bristol, there's something called the Slapstick Festival. And one of my guests within the clearing of The Good Listening To has also been Chris Daniels, who runs the Slapstick Festival. And I know they featured the Dog Doodah band there, as Bonzo Dog Doodah band there as well.
Of course, we worked with the Bonzos. When we go back to the Scaffold, we had our number one. And at the time in the charts, also what's the famous Bonzo spaceman?
Yes.
Urban spaceman. I'm the urban spaceman. That was racing up the charts, and Little Pink was racing up the charts. And we all wondered which one would get there first. But we joined up then, because Scaffold was sort of running out of steam in a way. We were doing different things, and we did a few shows with this the Bonzos. And then we morphed into a group called Grimms.
Mm-hmm.
We toured for about 2 years, made an album or two, so we're good. And that so was an acronym for Gorman, Roberts, Innes, McGough, McGeer, Stanchall. So it was John Gorman, Scaffold, and Andy Roberts, who was a great musician, and then Neil Innes, McGough, McGeer, by McGeer, Stanchall. And that was great fun, because, you know, they provide a lot of music, and we did the silliness, and poetry, music, so on.
And by the way, also, I really enjoyed researching you just this morning, just to touch base about, oh, great, I'm bringing you into my clearing. And the fact that you you had an old pair of Paul McCartney's trousers discovered in your attic, which was a blue mohair pair of pants, apparently.
Indeed. Yeah, indeed. And I they were given to me, excuse me, years and years ago, early Scaffold days, before we'd gone professional, I think, just doing shows. And Mike got a snappy dresser. I was a teacher then. I was a geography teacher, dressed like a geography teacher. And Mike used to be given Paul's cast-offs. Paul's then they were taken off there. They were going around in their suits, coming out of his ears, and down to Carnaby Street. Another show, another suit. Great, you know, snappy dresser, Paul McCartney, of course. They gave Mike some of his old stuff, and Mike then passed them on to me. They sharpened me up. Somebody gave me a suit and a pair of trousers and a shirt. And I tried them on, but I put them away. Didn't wear them very much. And then give the trousers to another friend of mine, Mike Hart. And then years and years and years later, I went up to the attic, going through my stuff, and found the shirt and pair of trousers. Thought, oh, Paul's trousers, wow. But all the moths had got them.
Uh-huh.
They got straight for the clutch, and all around the clutch, all his holes. So, so those are any vague ideas about, you know, selling dress. if I would, you know, no, I won't do that. So wrote a poem, wrote this poem, which is published, called Michael's Trousers. And it's about finding the trousers, discussing it, and then say, what would I do with them? And then eventually I had them framed, and now they hang in the Tate Gallery next to Peter Blake and, you know, David Hockney, and people walk past admiring. That was the poem. And I thought, hey, why don't I make a work of art? Inverted comma. And so I made two works of art, two inverted comma. And I, with the help of some of the art gallery in Liverpool Art Museum, they now have been hanging there. So the trousers on canvas with a poem written down the side, and they're up and they're on display, and they're lovely. But at some point I'll be looking for a buyer, you know, because there's any amazing canvas.
And in fact, you may even be able to sell them back to Paul McCartney himself, you know, because I, you know,
I'd have to ask Paul first.
And the poem you wrote, is it called To Macca's Pants or To Macca's Trousers?
Trousers. I think trousers.
Lovely. So, Roger, again, thanks so much for joining me. I'm going to curate you through the journey of the Good Listening To podcast. Where
it's all going so well. I thought it was all going so well, Chris.
It is, which is why I'm now delighted to.
I know, you're ducking out now.
I'm not talking that. I'm going to take you through the curation of the clearing. And I'm intrigued to know, you know, in all your world travels and all of your wonderful words that you've penned. Mm. One question I am gagging to ask you later on is, of all the things you have written, which is your favourite poem, which may be an impossible question.
Okay.
Bank that. But anyway, it's all to play for. I'm going to take you into a place called the clearing. And then I arrive with a tree in your clearing. Then I shake your tree to see which storytelling apples fall out. And you're already giving me lots of those anyway, which is lovely. Then we talk about alchemy and gold. There's a cheeky bit of Shakespeare, even some late entry Roger McGough too, if you like, and a cake, where we talk about legacy as well. So, Roger McGough, welcome to the clearing of the Good Listening To, Your Life and Times with me, Chris Grimes. What is a clearing like for you? Where do you go physically or metaphorically to get clutter-free and able to think?
Well, the first reaction, of course, I come here, you know, where I work and where I study. And I've always had a place where I go to work. It hasn't always been a study, as you imagine, when I started writing as a teacher. It could be anywhere. It could be when I first had kids, it could be the bedroom or anywhere, you're just on your own, really, with a bit of quiet and a pen and paper. So that would be one obvious one, really. Other ones, less obvious, will be a pub table. I have to jog in the morning, get pissed at night. not quite like that. But I do like going to local pub, always like the pub. Not to get drunk, but to go there and just to talk to mates, and to learn and to listen and to talk and try things out on them. And I will often try out a poem on my friends, and they're very good about it. I just written a poem, and anybody can read it, anyone interested? There you go. Oh, God. Rog, please. We'd love to hear a poem. Sorry, the poem. And that's where trying it out. And just the jokes, the fun, the bonhomie, it's good. Yes. Keep me in touch with the community and all that. And the third one, most surprising, might be during certain parts of the year, certain times of the year, rather, is the bowling green. And the bowling green of the Rolling Barns, the back of the Sun Inn. And that's a nice place to go and play bowling.
By the way, you share that in common with my father as well. My father will be delighted. My dad runs the Syston Bowls Club near Leicestershire.
Your dad and I are going to get on, aren't we? Thanks.
My dad and you would really get on, and this is lovely. Also, you mentioned the pub, and there's a pub table where you might sit with a pen and paper. Mm-hmm. In your local pub, do you have a sort of particular table they always make sure you can sit at?
Well, no, not quite that, not that kind. And I don't necessarily write there. I join a mate. It's a mate of mine. There's a bookbinder, actually, and a few other friends. They change over the years, as you can imagine, Chris. Over the years, living in different places, living in Liverpool.
Yes.
I'm a local pub there. I've been in Notting Hill Gate, I'm a local pub. Now I'm in Barnes, I'm a local pub, the Red Line. And going there, and there'll be friends there, and someone will have a table and I will join them. One of the friends may or may not join us. And but so someone there I know, and it's just for an hour.
By the way, why I asked that was because I live in Bristol. I've been to the Slad Valley before, and I remember going to the pub where Laurie Lee used to go, the Wolfpack. Mm. And I know that there was always his favourite chair and his table.
That's right.
Yeah, so I wondered if you had an equivalent.
Good, great man, lovely man, Laurie. Knew him quite well.
So if I may, I'm going to arrive at with a tree now in the clearing of your choice. And thank you for spoiling me for choice and giving me three. We've either got the pub, we've got the bowling green, or we've got, what was the third one you said?
The study.
So where would you like me to arrive with a metaphorical tree?
Better be on the bowling green.
Let's do that. My dad will enjoy that too. So this is a bit Waiting for Godot-esque, if I may, because of my sort of acting and theatre background. I'm going to arrive with a metaphorical tree, and I'm going to shake your tree to see which storytelling apples fall out. And this is where you've been kind enough, Roger McGough, wonderful Merseybeat poet, to have thought about four things that have shaped you, three things that inspire you. I will recap on this. Two things that never fail to grab your attention, and borrow from the film Up. That's a bit, squirrels, what never fails to grab your attention, whatever else is going on in your life. And then a quirky or unusual fact about you. So where would you like to shake your canopy? Which apples do you want to crunch on?
The first one, what shaped me, I suppose. Is that long? I suppose inevitably what shaped me was the city which I grew up in, which is Liverpool. So that really shaped the sort of, to some extent, the person I became, I think. And my parents, my dad worked on the docks in Liverpool all his life. My mum had to work the rest of her life. And my mum was one of 13 in the family, dad of one of 7. And so he worked on the docks, so there was never any money around at all. Never had holidays, never went abroad at all, never went out to eat, all those things. This is going back a long time, no money around. But my dad, my mum always brought me up to think how lucky I was. I was never, you weren't deprived, you weren't just, you weren't class family, working as out of the docks and made a little money. We never owned a house. We always rented a house, fight them out. I left, but it was a renting house. And so you were, by a lot of standards, poor. But we were told how lucky we were. You know, Roger, you're lucky, you know, to be born liberal. You know, you could be born in Bristol or Manchester. You know, you're lucky to be born in Liverpool. You're lucky to be Catholic. They're all Catholics, you know, there's some bad people out there. And you're lucky to have a mum and dad who love you. No, and have a mum and dad, you know, and it's true. So in a way, that's all you need. So just give you a sort of acceptance of things in a way.
And I'm hearing they imbued you with a sense of identity and pride in being Scouts.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's right. You don't. Yes, exactly that. You know, you pride in little things. The little things are the big things. That's certainly the thing. Yeah.
That's a lovely starter shapage. Thank you. The second thing?
What was the second? What was that? What was the second?
That'll be the next thing to have shaped you. So first of all, it's your parents and your sense
of
identity.
Language, I suppose. Language shaped me, inevitably. Yes, language. Going to school and learning to read. I remember there were no books around when I was a kid. There were no bookshops, as they say. Libraries were closed. But mum... very good. My mum taught me to read. She's got our HP bottles, sauce bottles. She used to read sauce bottles and sardine tins and tins of Ovaltine. And tucked up in bed, and she'd read the signs of the nights, fall asleep.
Read literally your early reading experiences, reading the back of an HP sauce bottle and
Ovaltine. My mum reading the back of the HP sauce bottle thing.
Oh,
the back
of the amazing.
I could be kidding here, I don't know. But I've written a poem, that's the poem. That's all I learned to read. And then going to school and learning language off a board. Remember, they used to learn the language in those days, alphabet. Ronnie's red rattle says R, and tired mother says and a big drawing of chair, and Ronnie's red rattle with a R. And the letters were visual to me, I remember.
Yes.
Was down, that language was a visual thing, and it moved around all the time. And yeah, it's a wing, really.
So you were talking about big alphabets on your school walls there.
Yes, I was. Yeah. These are big walls, big pictures.
Yes.
That's how we learned it. And I just like that. And I was always good at language. It's very different to literature, because it's silly, but I can jump on from primary school up to taking your GCSEs and all those things.
Yes.
I failed English literature, which a lot of surprises many people, but shouldn't they? I did well in English language. The reason was I failed literature because I didn't read the books. I didn't read the set books. You know, it's as simple as that. You don't read the Mare of Casterbridge or whatever it is. They pass your exams, but I was sort of busy doing other things. So language is always so important to me, and that was a main ever since.
So you were, if I may, you were sort of metaphorically doodling in your own scape of linguistics.
Good way of putting it, yeah, doodling in the air.
I relate to that, rather than reading the set text, which you have to read, and if they're prescribed, we never like doing anything we're told to do.
That's right, yeah. And I was sort of looking out the window and should have been paying attention, that sort of thing. In fact, one of my new books coming out, he said, modestly, is a children's book called My First Poem. And that's very much going back to what we're talking about. It's a child, beginning of the book, but like 12 poems, called Today I Am Writing My First Poem. That's about the child trying to recapture that in the middle of a classroom and trying to write a poem, because you had to, being told. And at first, resisting. What's the point? What's this for? What's the point? And then eventually being drawn into it by staring out the window, you know, and seeing what happens. And looking at the words and let them take over sometimes, and then stepping in gently and order them, and you know, they become your friends. So come back to that sort of language thing, because it's been
And I love the idea that you're staring out the window and your imagination is beginning to run wild in the outer reaches of outside the window.
Yeah, it is in a way, yes. And they're always influenced by the language that people use, and children use, they come to it. And my own kids saying things like, you know, "Oh, Dad, look, Dad, a bit dropped off the moon." And he looked up, and of course it's like half moon, and I sort of think, it's dropped off the moon. And if you're not careful, you say, "No, don't be silly, it's dropped off the moon. Don't Google it." But what you've got to do is encourage that sort of seeing. There's a nice story about the it didn't happen to me, but a friend of mine, his child, going past Didcot power station, big power station, and the kids said, "Oh, look, a cloud factory."
Oh, lovely.
That's lovely, isn't it?
Yeah.
Clear thing, you see. And I was saying good teachers and good parents encourage that in the child, not correct them. Not say, "Oh, no, no,
I think that's the most delicious rebranding for the Didcot power station. I think it's been felled now, but to call it a cloud machine.
So I love the way children talk in that way and see the world. And I just think every child is a poet, naturally. And that is a natural poet, often until they go to school. That's not knocking teaching at all or school. It's just that even the best parents themselves and teachers will sort of set the child on the route towards knowledge and education and correct them, say, "No, you must find out the facts. That's how things work," and how much education is geared towards knowledge, getting right answers, and factual, and at the cost of the creative side of
things. So I'm hearing that we have a shared love of improvisation and the nature of just getting your imagination wild there.
And doing that, not knowing where it's going to go and that sort of thing. And it is difficult to explain, isn't it? You probably find and to rationalise and to, when you're talking about other people saying the importance, get a job, you must get a job and get a good job, that's important. And what's the point of doing art? What's the point of painting? You know, it's very nice, but can I get anywhere? Is it? Roger was writing, very good, but let's do something. Get on your maths, get on your, do medicine, do, whatever, something that's going to be good for everybody. Where's that going to get you?
You're also describing beautifully the journey and story of a sort of non-conformist and more of a sort of societal maverick. You go in the different direction to be inventive.
I don't think it should be seen as, we see it as mavericks. You're saying what people see it as. It isn't. It's just a basic thing. But the basic child is creative, and that creativity should be just encouraged. And so there's nothing maverick about it. It's nothing rebellious about it. It's rebellious because we built a society in which it is. If we built a society with that as the core.
Yes.
This is hard to do, but there have been educationalists out there who go for this, and let's rethink how we can inspire our children and make a society work, and there'll be good jobs. They'll come out of it. They'll all be poets or painters, God wouldn't want that. There'll be the mathematicians and scientists and the physicists, but there's a part of them that is, is also open to imagination.
I love that. Open to imagination. Lovely. And if you've got a copy of your new book to hand, by all means, at the very end, show it up to the screen, please.
All right. I haven't, but I've got a postcard.
And we're still in the canopy of your trees, if I'm right, and we could be about to either do a fourth thing that shaped you, or we could be onto three things that inspire you now, whatever you'd like to do.
All right. Put me on a separate thing. I'm just going to show you this now before I've got it, then it'll disappear. Can you see that?
Holding it up. Safety in Numbers, Roger McGough, is the new book.
That's to look at, yeah. So the books aren't arrived yet. They're still on the back of an HGV lorry without a driver, somewhere between China and here, unfortunately. But anyway, they'll arrive one day. Yes, Chris, what are we doing now? I'm thinking of other things.
Yes, and by the way, that's really lovely that your books are actually caught in transit between somewhere in China and a lorry. But thank you for wonderfully showing us the icon there. Safety in Numbers, lovely. Just replanting that seed for you. Yeah, so three things that inspire you now.
Been almost the same things, really. It's language, people, and what I look out the window. It's all those things. It's no particular thing that inspires me. It's,
By the way, that is a lovely answer, because I'm loving the reincorporation of just it, you always default to the wonderful world of the imagination outside of the window, which is a lovely reincorporation.
Yeah, in a sense, and you know, when I and as you do, I know you were in workshops for speakers and imagination, as I did with poetry. And part of it is not just giving them my students come along. They will bring poems they like, and that's good, and they will write poems, and they often want something to write about, and you're going to give them a theme, a narrative. And I'm sort of, narratives will occur and will come in inevitably, but you don't, that's not always necessarily a good starting point. It could be just the words themselves, see where the poem takes you, look the poem, give the poem a free rein. So when I keep coming back, it's imagination and things I need. It is that. Anyway. Yeah, do you want quirky facts? What one?
Lovely, and that makes me think of an artist flinging paint at the canvas and then seeing yeah. what they create.
Yeah.
With the anarchy of words, I love that, and imagination. Okay, so two things that never fail to grab your attention. Whatever else is going on in your life, what never fails to, whoop, squirrels, grab your attention, Roger McGough.
I don't get the hoop squirrels bit. I never understand what you mean. Famous film about squirrels, hoop squirrels.
Well, forgive the reference. There is a film called Up where a dog is always distracted by shiny things. And in his case, the shiny thing's always like, oh, squirrel. You know, whatever you're doing, you get distracted and run after the squirrels. So in my life, it might be something like a ping pong table, because I love table tennis.
Yes, I have downstairs a table tennis table. So after this is finished, maybe we could. I used to love table tennis. I used to play when I was at school. Yeah, I played in the local youth club. That's quite handy. And had a Barna bat, Victor Barna. Remember Victor Barna?
Before yes.
He was the famous Hungarian ping pong table tennis player. He used to play that.
And I remember Desmond Douglas, by the way. You've just remembered a random okay. name of a brilliant black table tennis player.
Yes, excellent.
Desmond Douglas.
And then I played in university. And then, but never, nothing much since, but I like table tennis. I used to play cricket. I have a cricket ball somewhere around here. I used to play cricket. So things like that, I was, when I'm walking down the road around, and there's a park nearby, and a cricket team's playing there, and I can't always pop on my, for cricket generally, I never stop, I've got to stop and watch.
And as you remember, by the way, where we go in France to the English Sisters and Les Sœurs Anglais near Vertiac, Katie Elliott Armitage has a whole annex with a ping pong table in it, which I'm sure you've seen.
That's right. Yes. Oh, yes.
And listen, Roger, it would be an absolute joy to attempt to paddle you into defeat, if you don't mind me saying. It's not about the winning, it's the taking part. It's not really, but it'd be lovely to try and play you at table tennis someday.
Okay, get down that.
Wonderful. So now, a quirky or unusual fact about you we couldn't possibly know until you tell us.
Have you heard about my winning a baby competition, Bonnie Baby competition, when I was 18 months old?
No, you won. So just a Bonnie Baby competition at the age of 18 months old.
Yes. Don't people know that? I thought everybody knew that. Yes, 18 months. I remember it.
As a first memory, you remember that?
I've seen the photographs. I've seen the photographs. My mum holding me. I was a baby of the competition. There's baby, different babies, different categories, you know, different ages. And I was the overall winner. I won an overall. I don't remember much of that, but I remember just being, life's been downhill since then.
I could tell you must have been a beautiful baby, as the expression has it. So, yes, it's lovely that you went back.
I was beautiful.
And by the way, that's a nice segue as we come up to the seven ages of man. I know your poem is about getting to 104, and please get beyond that. But we'll talk about legacy and how you'd most like to be remembered. And of course, the seven ages of man ends up going back into infancy. So there'll be a lovely full circle, maybe, as you know. Any other quirky facts while we've got you doing quirky facts?
Is it quirky the fact that I won a ballroom dancing competition when I was a student and a member with my then girlfriend, Josephine? We won it. No, I was on university. We won a competition, ballroom dancing, and then we went to the semi-final in Hull at the City Hall. And then we wanted to go into the final. We were then invited to the final down in London, but we didn't go because it was too far and we couldn't afford it.
So this could be your hat in the ring, Roger McGough, for going on
Strictly.
The next series, Roger McGough, world official. He wants to be in the next series.
No. That's an odd thing, yeah. Quite, I think it's quite, isn't it?
And again, I'm very admiring of your dancing acumen as well. At drama school, if we did dancing, I would be famous for sort of taking out the back row. I'm not naturally gifted. I like physical comedy, but I'm not very, very good at dancing, okay. I have to say.
Okay,
so listen, we've shaken your tree and you're still very happily here in the clearing. In the structure of it now, what we're going to talk about next is about alchemy and gold, in the metaphor of what I'm talking about. So when you're at purpose and in flow, Roger McGough, and this may not be too surprising an answer, but what are you happiest doing when you're at purpose and in flow?
There are different things, aren't there? I mean, the completion, the start of starting a poem, obviously, at beginning something, an idea or something, is great, and finishing it is even. It's better. I don't know whether it is. It's funny enough, you know, when I finished the last poem for the book, new book, there's a bit of feeling of loss, actually. You know, God, what we're going to do now?
Yes. Oh gosh, do you always have that? Whenever you finish a poem, you leave the end of the paper. You fall off the end of the world of that paper and that poem.
I know, that's right. And that, so that's sort of thing. So it's a great thing to start a book. And to be on the side of the stage, as I have been the last few days, again, luckily doing shows around the country in Worcester and Birmingham and off to Liverpool next week in Halifax. And that thing picking up after a year, you imagine. I mean,
yes, lockdown.
It was March, yeah, it's much in March. The 11th, 2020, was the last gig I did before the lockdown, and that was in Liverpool. It wasn't a public gig. It was for head teachers and English teachers, and talking about poetry at school. And it was great. But that was the Saturday of the Liverpool versus Atletico Madrid game, and Liverpool was full of Spaniards, and you know, great atmosphere, but. There was a feeling that they were introducing COVID into England, if you may remember.
Yes.
And there was a feeling very quickly that that was a mistake. I remember on the train going back and people were a bit shifty. And someone was coughing and someone was looking.
Yes.
And after that, I was at the end of, you know, just like everybody else in lockdown, and which has just opened the game. And so there's something just nice about, you know, being in a dressing room.
So getting back on the open road and the joy of performing and the buzz of performing.
Yeah, and that'll last until I get a bit tired of reading the poems. I mean, they're all new poems to me and I'm discovering new things in them and changing them as I go along. In fact, I'm saying different things as I read them to what's actually written in the book.
Yes.
Because you keep developing things and changing things. So that's all good.
And I'm assuming that when the poem obviously is published, that's the point it's locked off as a poem, even though you may evolve it in your
own. That's right. Head. And I will continue changing that. In fact, some of the poems in the book are poems of old poems of mine that I've revisited, rewritten, and come out again, you know, and some will know, some won't know, you know. That's what artists do all the time, don't they? Painters revisit old things, David Hockney, go back to this and do about that.
And when was the last time you wrote a poem? Obviously, we're here on the 12th of October. So when did you last write a poem, Roger McGough?
Last week, I suppose. Yeah, last week, about 10 days ago.
And by the way, just while I'm just discussing, I dug this out of my cupboard. It's your book, Lucky. Poems by Roger McGough that I got given. It says at the front, I was called by my wife, Happy Birthday, Mr. Lucky, and I got this in 1994. And as I mentioned, we do have Poetry Please in common and Viv Beebe. I mentioned that just before we started recording.
Viv Beebe, yes. Wonderful wonderful producer, yes. No, Viv.
And there was a production of Hiawatha and I was doing that, but then I think you came up on stage and were doing poems in the interval bits. Okay. So it was, this is not the first time I've met you. I resisted saying this is not the first time you've met me because this is about you, not about me.
You had a headdress on, if I remember then, didn't you? A big headdress.
Thank you. I make a beautiful Hiawatha.
Yes.
Lovely. Thank you for remembering that. Wonderful. And so we've talked about alchemy and gold, and I love the idea of the sort of still the joy of performing and being in the wings, ready to come on. When we were corresponding about, you know, finalising the date today, you were about to be in Brummie. You said Brummie tomorrow in one of the last texts I got from you. Okay, so now I'm going to award you with a cake. Now we've talked about alchemy and gold and when you're at your happiest. So the cake is my final storytelling metaphor, where this is a multi-layered cake. And you'll see where I'm going with this, Roger McGough. But first question to you is, do you like cake, Roger?
I like cake, yes. I like cake very much. I like cake.
And I hope you get lots of cake at the bowling green, as my dad does. But what type of cake?
Yesterday, Lem Sissé got around yesterday.
Who did?
Lem Sissé, the poet.
Oh,
writer, wonderful, great guy. Doing a show, and the engineer brought a piece of cake his wife made for me because she likes my poem, and that was great, and the cake's great. So when we finish this chat, I'm going downstairs and I'm going to finish off the cake.
And what type of cake are we talking, Roger?
It's nice. I don't know. It's like a lemony, cheesy, chocolatey, strawberry, custardy. Type of thing.
That sounds like my kind of cake. Yes, so let's nom nom nom, let's go for all of that. And so now the invitation is for you in that delicious cake that I know you're looking forward to finishing off. This is the cherry on the cake of the conversation, the legacy of our conversation. So the cherry's metaphor is, could I find out for you what is your favorite inspirational quote that's always, or your favorite line of poetry? You can interpret this as you wish. So a favorite inspirational quote. It could be the best piece of advice you've ever been given, or it could be, you know, as we've talked about your wonderful poem, Let Me Die a Young Man's Death, what advice might you offer to a younger version of yourself? And then finally, inspired by Shakespeare and all the world's a stage, when all is said and done, Roger McGough, and may you go well beyond 104, what would you like your legacy to be? How would you most like to be remembered?
I think the advice, the best advice I had, it's funny, when in the newspaper article and people say the best advice they ever have, and it was reading them, and I don't know, it's all good, it's all well-meaning, but best advice, Charles Causey was a favorite, one of my favorite poets. Years and years ago, almost I had one book published, wasn't really well-known, and I was with him, met him, and he liked my work. Obviously, and we were traveling back from somewhere. And he said, Roger, you critics will often not like your poetry. I think, why are you saying that? Critics. Yes, he said, you like poetry, you have books published, and critics will often not like it. Take no notice. You're a poet, just carry on. You're the one. I thought, And I didn't quite know what he's on, because I didn't really have any bad reviews at that time. They did come in later, and there was a sort of reaction against, particularly the Liverpool poets and the Mersey Sound, and there was a sort of,
yes,
rather sniffy critics regarded it as unspoken word poetry and like that, as being not poetry, and if it's funny, it's not poetry, you know, and it's like the children, it's not really poetry. And if you come from Liverpool, can't really be poetry, can it? So, you know, you have this like snobbish sort of aggression here and there. So, in a way, I was bore in mind what Charles said, that, you know, just go on doing it. You know, you were going to do it anyway. Just go and ignore them. Just go on. So, that's it. Ignore bad criticism generally. Think about it, but then.
And so wonderful you are keeping going with your last poem just being just this last week. And I don't doubt you've got a bit of paper at the ready for your next one. So, yes, keep going. Please keep going.
Thank you.
And what advice might you proffer to a younger version of yourself?
That really, I mean, that's all. I mean, you know, I go back to being a Catholic, you know, sort of church and all those things. I've kept on some things. Most people don't. Yeah, and see why. I have to question myself, saying, well, church on Sunday, why do you say your prayer? But I do, and so it was like help me along. You don't really need help along, but it's just something you do, become part of your life, part of the structure of your life. So don't be afraid of admitting to it.
Wonderful. And then, if I may, then, even if this is similar, but inspired by Shakespeare and All the World's a Stage, when all is said and done, when you make it well beyond 104, and again, I keep referencing Let Me Die a Young Man's Death because it is an absolute favourite, iconic poem of mine, a favourite of yours. But how would you most like to be remembered, Roger McGough?
Well, that's the title of my autobiography.
Roger McGough, Said and Done, I'm reading in the screen.
Said and Done, yep. You turned the Said and Done. So I said it and did it, in a way. So Roger McGough, Said and Done.
Letting that hang there beautifully. Roger McGough, Said and Done. So, Roger McGough, this has been your moment in the sunshine in your life and times with me, Chris Grimes, where I've been giving you a good listening to. Is there anything else you'd like to say here in the clearing?
Let me out of here!
Because there is cake that awaits you downstairs. I'll just ask you one other question, if I may. Is there any way that you might consider reading a poem of choice to our listeners?
I'd rather not, because it's been going so well, Chris. I think, leave it like that.
We will leave it like that. So, okay. Roger, we've just had a good listening to In the Clearing with me, Chris Grimes, you're Roger McGough. Could I just ask you, what was that like for you? What was your experience of being here?
It was interesting and, it tickled my brain. It's no bad thing. And now I've got another lie down.
Lovely. And thank you. Do you mind if I take that? It tickled my brain, then that's no bad thing. Do you mind if I take that as a quote?
No,
that's lovely.
Okay.
And enjoy your cake, lovely man. And thank you so much, by the way. I'm really, really happy that you've been willing to say yes. And thank you for saying yes. And
all right, Chris.
Reg Starkey also sends his very best, as does Katie.
Oh, good. Yes. Well. Good. All right, Chris.
Good luck with the book, too. And I will definitely be looking out for you. Okay, bye.
Bye, man. Bye,
ping
man.
Pong as well. We must play ping pong.
Oh, yeah.
Bye. See you, Roger.
Bye.
So my sincere thanks. What a great day in the Good Listening to Clearing to have Roger McGough, who, as I mentioned at the beginning, his lovely Scouse dulcet tones have been ringing around inside my head in a really good way all of my life. And he's the same birth year as my dad, so I find him incredibly relatable and indeed adorable. And I kept talking about Let Me Die a Young Man's Death. So if I may, I'm just going to finish by giving you a reading of that poem. I won't try and do a Scouse accent, but, he does it in a way which only he could do. But anyway, let me die a young man's death. Not a clean and in-between-the-sheets holy water death. Not a famous last words, peaceful out-of-breath death. When I'm 73 and in constant good tumour, may I be mown down at dawn by a bright red sports car on my way home from an all-night party. Or when I'm 91 with silver hair and sitting in a barber's chair, may rival gangsters with ham-fisted Tommy guns burst in and give me a short back and insides. Or when I'm 104 and banned from the cavern, may my mistress, catching me in bed with her daughter and fearing for her son, cut me up into little pieces and throw away every piece but one. And while I was talking to Roger, he said, his ear, obviously. Let me die a young man's death, not a free from sin, tiptoeing candle wax and waning death, not a curtains drawn by angels born. What a nice way to go, death. So yes, what a privilege talking to the lovely Roger McGough. I also mentioned the poem Waving at Trains, which all my life, whenever I see anybody waving at a train, child, adult or anyone else, or indeed if I do the same, I always think of Roger McGough. So do people who wave at trains wave at the driver or at the train itself? Or do people who wave at trains wave at the passengers, those hurtling strangers, the unidentifiable flying faces? So, yes, that was Roger McGough's wonderful words. I've been Chris Grimes. This has been the Good Listening to Show, Your Life and Times with me, Chris Grimes. Until next time, for more stories in the clearing, thank you very much indeed to your good health and goodbye. You've been listening to the Good Listening To show here on UK Health Radio with me, Chris Grimes. Oh, it's my son.
If you've enjoyed the show, then please do tune in next week to listen to more stories from The Clearing.
If you'd like to connect with me on LinkedIn, then please do so. There's also a dedicated Facebook group for the show too. You can contact me about the programme, or if you'd be interested in experiencing some personal impact coaching with me, care of my Level Up Your Impact programme, that's chris@secondcurve.uk. On Twitter and Instagram, it's
@thatchrisgrimes.
So until next time, for me, Chris Grimes, from UK Health Radio, and from Stan,
to your good health.
And goodbye.